Thank you very much for the kind introduction and the opportunity to be here today. So last Friday, we released our financial stability review. We publish this once every 6 months, and it's typically around about April and October each year. And what I'm going to do today is talk you through basically what we talk about in the financial stability review. But first of all, I thought it would be worth just outlining for you what the Reserve Bank's role in financial stability is, because you know about monetary policy, but you may not know that we have a number of other functions as well, one of which is oversight of overall system stability. So we've always had this role, and it stems really from we're at the centre of the payment system in the Reserve Bank. We're the provider of liquidity and the lender of last resort. And also, prior to 1998, we supervised the banks. Now, in 1998, the supervision of the banks went to an integrated regulator, which was APRA, so we didn't have that role, but we still retained responsibility for overall financial system stability. So how do we interpret this mandate? We don't have any tools, because APRA supervises the banks, so how do we think about it? Well, what we think about, really, our objective is to ensure that financial disturbances in any part of the financial system don't flow on to the economy. That's our main aim. And we recognise that if you have financial instability, it can have very real consequences for people in terms of financial distress, in terms of unemployment, these sorts of things. You only have to look at the GFC to realise this. So we are looking at a whole lot of indicators, really, financial market indicators, overseas economies, what's going on in Australia in terms of debt and the banks and so on. We look at all of these broad macro financial indicators and try to get a feel for where we think the tail risks might be. What could go wrong? So I've got my job is to worry, if you like. All of this interacts with other areas of the bank. We obviously have responsibilities for monetary policy, we have financial markets and payments. So it's sort of logical in a way that we've also got this broad responsibility for financial stability. Now, when we set interest rates, we're really focused on inflation and what is our flexible medium-term inflation target. But interest rates can also impact other things such as asset prices. So although in setting interest rates we're not sort of focusing on asset prices, it's something that's sort of in the background there, just to remind us that interest rates can have impacts on financial stability. So we don't have any tools to impact financial stability there with APRA. So what do we have? Well, one of the things we have is the Financial Stability Review, and that's where we air issues we have, questions we have, concerns we might have about risks in the financial system. So what I thought today is I'd just take you through some of the slides and some of the things we're thinking about in financial stability. The key thing, I think, is that there has actually been a little bit of improvement in the world economy of late, in the last 6 months. And that's actually meant that we think the financial stability risks have sort of decreased a little bit. And it's actually quite positive for bank profitability as well. But as I said, I've got a worry hat, and I put my worry hat on, and I'm going to take you through five key themes, I think, of where we think things are a little concerning for us. But I'm paid to worry, so that's me. So I'm going to start with, these are a few indicators of financial market prices. So the top left corner there, estimated term premium in US Treasuries. US Treasuries are effectively the government, so they're risk-free rates. And what that's telling you is that for a 10-year bond, you're actually getting no higher return than you would get in the short term. So there is no return for taking on term risk, 10 years worth of risk. There's none at all. So that's sort of a very... you see that the last time it was down around zero was just around about before the financial crisis. So this is telling you that people are not factoring in any risk for over that 10-year period, any risk of inflation. If you look at the top right corner, these are non-investment grade corporate bonds, and this is the premium of those that you earn on those bonds over the risk-free rate, over treasuries. And again, what you'll see that both for the euro and the US dollar, you'll see that the spreads have come right down. So this is saying that people's reward for taking on credit risk is actually falling, and it's quite low, and it's not quite as low as pre-GFC, but it's still pretty low. So rewards for taking on risk over time, very, very low. Rewards for taking on credit risk, very, very low. And then the two bottom panels talk about volatility. So this is these are derived measures from options prices, but basically, so they're saying, what is the expected volatility of US Treasury bonds and equities over the next little while? And what you'll see is that expected volatility in these markets is very, very as low as well. So risk premium are very low, volatility is very low, and I think there's generally a concern that perhaps there's a bit of complacency out there, and that with this complacency, if something happened unexpected, that all of these things could reverse. And if these things reverse and interest rates rise quite sharply, then this could have implications for the economy. So this is sort of a bit of a concern that we have, and we're watching it closely, but at the moment there does seem to be a bit of a complacency about risk. The second thing that theme that I want to talk about is China. Now, we highlight this in the FSR and we have for some time. This is a graph of China's non-financial debt to GDP. So it's not the banks, it's non-financial. And the three bars, the dark green bar is corporate borrowings from banks, and then the slightly lighter green bar is corporate borrowings from other sources. For that, read non-banks, or sometimes called shadow banks. And then the top bar is households. So you see the total debt is over 200% of GDP. That's very high. And another thing you'll notice is that the green bars, which shows you their corporate borrowings from banks, corporate borrowings from banks haven't really changed as a percent of GDP, but the big the increase in corporate borrowings has occurred from these other sources. So this is the non-regulated sector, it's the non-banks. And because of these non-banks, they're very opaque, it's very difficult to see what they're doing, they're not regulated, they're probably taking on higher credit risks. So there is some concern that there's some lending going on here which isn't particularly prudent, particularly to the corporate sector. And the corporate sector in China has some of its own issues, overcapacity in some cases, loss-making, these sorts of things. So there's a bit of a concern that the Chinese financial system has introduced risks to the Chinese economy in this way. Just to give you a little more on that, this shows you income per capita along the bottom scale, and then on the top, the vertical scale, is non-financial corporate debt to a percent to GDP. So all of the little dots there, so it's telling you China's real GDP per capita is sort of quite low, but its corporate debt to GDP is really, really high. So some of the little dots in the bottom corner there with a similar GDP per capita to China are places like Indonesia and Mexico, India. They've got much lower corporate debt levels. China's right off the scale there. So this is just another concern that perhaps in their process of liberalising their financial markets, things are getting a little out of hand. Corporate debt is rising, and some of that corporate debt may not be very good credit. So theme number two. So theme number one was risk. Theme number two, China. Theme number three is a bit closer to home, and this is something that you'll all be familiar with, I think, and this is the housing price story. So this graph shows you growth in housing prices in four different cities and by different dwelling type. The red line is houses and the blue line is apartments in each of these cities. And the story is that in recent times, it's been a Melbourne and Sydney phenomenon that prices are in apartments and houses have been rising very sharply. They've come off a bit lately, you'll notice, but really it's been a Sydney-Melbourne-centric story. You'll see that in Brisbane and Perth, Perth in particular, has issues since the mining boom has finished. They've had, in fact, declining prices in housing, apartments and houses. Brisbane, I'll come to in a minute, but its prices of its houses seem to be holding up reasonably well, but apartment prices have been declining. So this is a very familiar story, I think. You can't read a newspaper without hearing about this issue. Why do we worry about this? Well, the main reason we worry about this is because what it implies about debt for the households. So this graph shows you household mortgage debt, and on the left-hand side you have debt, aggregate debt to income of households for mortgages. The right-hand side gives you some measures of serviceability. So just concentrate on the left-hand side for the moment. So the debt-to-income ratio rose very sharply through the 1990s, and that was sort of when deregulation was going on in the financial system. Credit constraints were being removed. People were able to borrow more. And then it levelled off a bit after the GFC, but it started to rise again as people have borrowed more and more money to finance housing, both owner-occupiers and investors. Now, and it's been rising quite sharply, and it's now well above 120, it's around about 130, 135%. Two points to make about this. The first is that that's been exacerbated because at the same time debt's been rising very sharply, incomes have been growing quite slowly. So that's exacerbated the rise. The second point is the dashed line below it actually gives you a little more confidence because that says that there are people that are not paying off their debt, but they're actually socking a bit of money away in an offset account. So they have a buffer of funds, giving them a bit of flexibility. And if you take those buffers off the total level of debt, you get that dashed line there. So that's not been rising as quickly. So that tells you that people are being a little bit prudent. They're taking on more debt, but they're also accumulating cash buffers so that if things don't turn as they expect, they might have a little bit of leeway. The other thing to the right-hand side of the graph now is you'll see the blue line is just interest repayments to income. And you'll see that's been declining, and that's no surprise because interest rates are fairly low and interest rates have been declining. If you add in what they have to pay in terms of principal, which is the orange line, it gives you a total amount up the top, the purple line. So really, total scheduled repayments in aggregate have stayed around about 10% for the past few years. So there's not dangers lurking there yet, but if interest rates were to start to rise, then you might see, you will see, this repayments to income ratio start to rise. So that's a little cause for just a little bit of concern that ultimately that might introduce a risk. What else do we know about this? Well, we also know that banks' non-performing loans have been rising a little bit in recent times. So this graph shows you past due loans, are loans that are 90 days overdue, but they're well secured. So there's a good amount of collateral there. Total non-performing loans also includes impaired loans. They're loans for which security is not as good. But you'll see it's still pretty low. It's it's below 1% of total assets of the banks, of their domestic books. So it's rising, but it's not at alert levels, but it's something to be watched. One other point I'd make about this is a lot of this rise is because of Western Australia. If you look at the non-performing loan ratios in most other states, they're actually reasonably stable. The rise here is reflecting Western Australia and their quite unique economic circumstances which have followed because of the mining boom and subsequent decline. A little bit of focus on this recently, you will have known, has been on the role of property investors in all of this process. What are property investors doing? So this graph shows you a little bit about what we know about property investors. So the share of the population, adult population, that are investors has risen over time. It's now a little bit under 12%, it's about 11%. It's risen over time. And the other thing you'll notice from the right-hand panel is that the share of people who are borrowing to get into investment property has risen as well over time. So it's been steady for the last decade, but around about 80% of investors in property are borrowing to invest in property. The bottom line is negatively geared, so around about 60% of those borrowers are negatively geared into that property, meaning they don't make as much money, income from the property, as it costs them. So that's been declining a little bit over time. That's the interest rate effect. So as interest rates have declined, the share has declined. But there's still a substantial proportion of investors who are negatively geared. So what do we know about these? Now, this we've used some information from the tax office to look at some characteristics. So the blue bar is 2003-04 and the green bar is 13-14. That's the latest data we have these data for, so we're sort of, it's a bit lagged. But what it's telling you is that there is a very substantial proportion of people in a relatively modest income bracket that actually are property investors. So that's quite interesting. Although, now, that's not surprising because people in those income brackets account for the bulk of taxpayers. So that's not surprising. But it still demonstrates for you that there are a lot of property investors that are of reasonable income, but not particularly high. We often think property investors must be earning lots and lots of money, but not all of them are. A large chunk of them are just earning reasonably average income. The other thing we know from these data is that over the decade, we've got 14-15 data for this particular comparison, is that the age distribution has shifted right. So there are more people age 60 plus who are investors now than there were a decade ago. Now, there could be a variety of reasons for this. Ageing of the population is one, but this shift is actually stronger than that. So there's more going on. There are actually, even accounting for the age shift, there are more people in older age brackets owning investment property. So, and the other point is that the light bars show people who've borrowed. So you'll see that between the decades, there's a substantial proportion more people who are borrowing in older age groups to finance investment property. So, you know, again, this might be a risk, it might not be a risk, but it does demonstrate something that the characteristics of investors in housing are changing. And the final thing that we know from this is that there actually has been a shift in the number of properties that people own. So around about 70% of investors own just one property. But actually, half of the investment properties are owned by investors with more than one property. And this has changed over time. So this graph basically shows you that the number of investors up the top and the annualised growth rate. So the number of people that own three or plus more investment properties has been rising on average over this decade by around 4% per annum. So people are increasingly adding to their portfolio. Most people only own one, but some people own many. So again, might be a risk if there's a downturn in the property market. Some people might be quite affected if they have geared up and entered into multiple properties. A little bit more on households generally. So you may have read that around about March, the Prudential Regulation Authority, with the support of the Reserve Bank, placed some restrictions on borrowing. And in particular, they said that no more than 10% of, no more than 30% of new loans could be interest-only loans, and that investor housing credit could not grow by more than 10%. Now, this has got a few lines on it, but let me just demonstrate. I'd like to start on the bottom panel, if you like. So since APRA introduced their rule that no more than 30% of new loans could be interest-only loans. You've seen a sharp drop-off in total investment loans that are interest-only, and it's been reflected particularly sharply in investor loans. So if you look at that right panel, that orange line says that prior to APRA's moves, over 60% of investors had interest-only loans, and it's dropped down below that now. Mm-hmm. Now, why we worry about interest-only loans, it's reasonably quite simple, because you're not paying off, you're not getting equity by paying off. And the worry is that, in fact, what people are banking on is price rises to get them equity. So there's a concern that that might introduce some risk to the market. The top panels refer to loan-to-valuation ratios, and the pink line's the sort of an interesting one. That's loan-to-valuation ratios over 90%. So people who had 10 or less percent deposit to put on, and they borrowed over 90%. And the share of that as a share of total loans has been declining over time. And that's, again, a prudent measure, because the less leeway you have on your debt and the value of your property, if property prices fall, the sooner you might fall into negative equity. Now, why do we worry about these property investors? I think a little bit of the concern with prices rising so quickly is that they might be counter-cyclical. They might bid the price up, and then when prices perhaps taper or start to come off, they might sell, they might try to get out. So they might amplify the whole process, and that's not good for the rest of us who are in our owner-occupied houses and might see the values decline in a much more magnified way. This just demonstrates a similar point, really, which is that housing growth itself is running at about 6.5%, which is the black line. The investor loans were growing sort of 8 or 9%. They've now come back, and owner-occupied loan growth has increased. So the effect of APRA's moves has been to sort of shift the composition of housing credit. Just very quickly on supply of apartments, this is an issue that we've been talking about for a while, and what I'd like you to focus on here is Brisbane. So what this demonstrates for you is apartment completions estimated in coming, so the history is actuals, and then you'll see in Brisbane that around about 25% of the current stock is due, the current stock is due to increase by 25% in the next 2 years. That's an awful lot of apartments to come into Brisbane. And what you're already seeing, in fact, is rents and prices decline in Brisbane. So we're sort of a little bit concerned that perhaps this supply is going to cause issues. Melbourne, you'll see, also has a reasonable supply coming on. Population growth in Victoria and Melbourne is actually looking like it's going to absorb this. So there might have been risk, but it actually looks a bit better now because Melbourne is really doing very, very well in terms of its economy at the moment. Just very briefly, I'm conscious of time. Office property, commercial property is also sometimes a risk. This sort of shows you vacancy rates in office properties, and you'll see Sydney, they're pretty low. Melbourne, they're pretty low. Very elevated in Perth, again reflecting its economic circumstances, but also in Brisbane. So there's, you know, this theme of Melbourne and Sydney look a little bit different, and it continues into the commercial property. In terms of banks' exposures to commercial property, the key point I'd like you to note from this is that the major Australian banks, which is the green line, they've sort of levelled out their exposures to commercial property. The Asian banks, the foreign banks, have actually sharply increased their exposures to property. We won't necessarily worry about this unless it looked like the major banks were lowering their lending standards to compete with some of these foreign banks, but they don't appear to be. They seem to be levelling off their exposures and maintaining sensible lending standards. And the exposures are largely rising in retail, and in residential. Offices sort of levelled off a bit, but the two areas where exposures are still increasing for the Australian banks are in retail and in residential. Retail has got, there's a lot of stories behind retail. I'm not a particular expert in this, but retail has got a lot of redevelopment going on. There's a lot of work going on in particular rail corridors and so on, and reusing current commercial space and repurposing it to get more out of it. Banks' non-performing assets. I talked a little bit earlier about non-performing loans in housing aren't very high. You'll see after GFC, business non-performing loans, GFC, they rose sharply. They've come right back and then they've been declining. Housing rising a bit. Personal loan arrears have been rising a bit, but that's a very, very small percentage of banks' exposure. So that's not going to really impact on the banks. Which leads me to my final theme, which is the banks themselves. So this is a graph of the bank's capital ratios. The right-hand, left-hand bar is the regulatory requirement, the minimum capital requirement, and then the orange bars show what the major banks' current capital levels are and the other ADIs. And you'll see that they are well above their minimum requirements. And in fact, their capital ratios have risen very strongly since the GFC. So if you look at the blue line, which is their Tier 1 capital, since GFC, and there was a very concerted worldwide effort to increase capital of the banking sector after that episode, you'll see that it's risen very strongly, and in fact, it's risen by around about 6 percentage points. So banks have increased their capital ratios very substantially around the world, but particularly here in Australia. So that's very positive for the banking system. The other thing that's reasonably positive for the banking system is profits. And it's positive in terms of stability of the banking sector. I know it gets a bit of bad press in other contexts. But the point about this is although profits aren't rising sharply, they are remaining reasonably solid. And that's good because it means that the banks have earnings, profits, which they can continue to raise their capital levels. They've still got to raise them a little bit further. APRA's set the bar a little bit higher for them, and they'll be able to do it through their profits. So that's a positive thing for them. And I'd finally like to just highlight, there's a little bit of a question about, well, if you start regulating the banks and saying they can't lend, won't others lend? You know, look at China. It's in the shadow banking system. It's not the regulated banking system. And this is just to demonstrate, really, that even though there are some constraints on bank lending, the share of housing credit that's being taken up by these non-banks is actually not rising. It's rising a little bit, but not very much. It's certainly not as high as it was pre-global financial crisis. So, and there's probably a few reasons for that, and one important one is just the cost of funding for these alternative players. It's too costly for them. So that's a bit of a tour around the main themes of the Financial Stability Review. I hope you found it slightly interesting. It's been very quick. But as I say, I think that with improved economic conditions, financial stability risks have softened somewhat. But my job is to worry, and these are the things I currently worry about. Thank you. Yes, I do. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
My first question would be, where will interest rates go? 2018, and I think the question for our share investors is short-term interest rates compared to long-term interest rates and the results of any balance in those. Can you comment on that?
I can't comment on where interest rates will go. I can recommend to you the minutes of the Reserve Bank Board meeting most recently, which was released on Tuesday, and the reasoning why interest rates are staying where they are at the moment. My job is to worry about the tail risks. My job isn't to actually decide what to do with the interest rate at the moment. But to your point about the difference between long-term and short-term interest rates, I mean, that is an issue at the moment. Long-term interest rates reflect expectations of what will happen to interest rates in the future, and that often reflects what people expect inflation to do. And at the moment, as I highlighted at the beginning, there's actually not much difference between short-term and long-term interest rates. There's a bit, but not much. So that's telling you something about people's expectations about inflation, and they're not expecting interest rates to rise very sharply in the near term. So,
any other question?
I have. Could you go back to the last slide, please? That non-ADI share of are those independent? Does that appear the peer-to-peer lending group?
So there's a couple of issues here. One, we don't have great data. Because they're not regulated institutions, you're quite right. Things like peer-to-peer lending you wouldn't capture here. However, said that, that would be very, very tiny. And I don't know if there's much peer-to-peer lending for housing, which is what is being captured here. This is very small. Peer-to-peer lending would be very, very tiny, even tinier than this.
Yeah. Because there are a couple of others where the peer-to-peer lenders, you've got to do your own homework and decide whether or not it's a good investment. But there are others who will actually do that, that research for you. Like, I think there's one called La Pro, who appeared at one of the SMS seminars recently in May and August. So they would be in that group as well. I've just got one more question, which is going back several slides, you talked about shadow banking and it was China. What's an example of them?
Well, they are non-banks. They are not regulated. I couldn't give you a name of a shadow bank in China, but they're not regulated. They have no capital requirements. And what they typically do is they borrow from the banks, and then they use that money to invest in either loans to other people, or they don't raise deposits. What they do is they actually borrow from banks, typically short-term, and then they loan them out to other firms, or perhaps invest them in equities or other wealth management products. So they're not facing the household. The household doesn't, but they are using funds from banks to basically on-source to others. That's the sort of institution they are.
Thank you. It's very informative.
Thank you.
Just a comment, if I may. With typical people in this room, for example, retirees, as people that need to invest to get a return on their money, the banks of 2% isn't helping very much. And they really have to put their money into equities or housing or some sort of property, which just increases the bubble and increases really the risk at some stage.
It's a very fair comment, and the whole this search for yield, so that's the term everyone uses, and because very low interest rates post-global financial crisis, the central banks had to keep very low interest rates to get their economies going, and that's resulted in a weight of money which needs to searching for yield, and you're quite right, this is where all these things are going. And as I highlighted at the beginning, I think the concern is that if something happens unexpected and things turn around quickly, yields will go up, but yields going up means asset prices will come down. So there's concerns about that.
The question of hacking, I'm just wondering if you can comment on the risk in the interbank settlements going towards direct. Also, if there's hacking on something like the stock exchange and perhaps manipulating results, etc., is there some way that the Reserve Bank is monitoring this type of risk?
So cyber risk generally is almost the number one topic, I think, internationally in terms of risks, operational risks. And I think if you ask anyone in the banks, financial market infrastructures like the stock exchange, cyber risk is right up the top of there. So I think there's a few things there. The first is that there's a lot of work going on globally because this is a global issue. This isn't just, you can't confine it to Australia. So there's a lot of work going on globally to identify institutions and firms that are potentially systemic in this sense, and identifying them and then trying to encourage them to put in place appropriate governance processes to ensure that their cyber risks are addressed. So there's a lot of, as I say, it's international standards going on there. The Reserve Bank directly oversees some of the clearing and settlement facilities that the ASX operates, and we are very focused on engaging with them on what their cybersecurity strategies are. More broadly, in terms of the payment system, the Reserve Bank is right at the middle of the payment system, where the interbank payment settlement system. I can tell you that it is a very, very firm focus of the Reserve Bank, and we have a very strong and robust cyber strategy ourselves as well.
Clancy Yates from the Sydney Morning Herald. You mentioned the Brisbane apartment market and all four of the apartments coming under debt. Do you think that's likely to cause some problems for the banks over the next few years?
It's difficult to say whether it'll cause any problems. I think the reason we're raising it as a risk is because the potential for price declines with large increase in supply is raised. There's a risk, and you're already seeing a little bit of a decline in prices. The issue for the banks, really, I think, the banks themselves are well capitalised. Generally, their lending standards are pretty good. As I mentioned, they have reduced the high loan devaluation loans. So provided they've got good enough security, I think the banks will be fine, and they're well capitalised. From a financial stability perspective, one of the things we are also concerned about, though, is the human aspect of this. And if prices start to decline, then that might cause concerns and hardship for people. So the banks might be okay, but the households might struggle. So I think there's a bit of a concern that if people were investing in Brisbane, expecting capital gains, expecting prices to rise, this mightn't occur. So I think probably the concern's a little more on the household resilience side than on the bank side.
I'm concerned about the fact that the QE and all of the United States, Europe here, everybody seems to have a massive amount of debt. How are we going to actually pay it off? What performance is that?
Well, debt can be a good thing. So debt isn't always a bad thing. So I guess I'd make that point first of all. The second thing is that, and I alluded to this in my graph of household debt, is that debt to income ratios are rising, but income is rising slowly. So if we can get income growing more quickly, that will help, because it gives people more opportunity to pay things off and gets them more equity. So I think that, you know, with the world economy improving, you'll get opportunities for incomes to start rising, a bit of inflation, incomes will rise, and debt-to-income ratios will be able to be stabilised in that respect. There's nothing wrong with having debt, provided it's productive debt.
How reliable is the data out of China, please?
Well, it's the best we've got. and I think they try to do a good job of collecting their data. The regulators there, so we get these data from their official institutions, and I think they try to do a good job of it. And as I say, it's all we've got, but we think they're trying to do a good job of it.
Especially when they bring them out the day before they're due.
Thank you so much. It really was extremely informative for me. I've just got one more question. In November of last year, there was this absolutely massive sell-off of bonds in the US. Would you comment on that? I mean, why did it happen?
It was the Trump trade, and basically the, you know, he was coming in under a platform of infrastructure spending and tax cuts, and And I think there was sort of a bit of a, everyone thought, oh, great, you know, growth, inflation, all those sorts of things. So bond rates, as I said earlier, they reflect what people think are going to happen to interest rates in the future. And that's what happened. So they jumped up and then they've come back a little bit since then. But really it was very much, I think it's even called the Trump trade.
Could I ask another question? With share markets maybe not giving the returns they have, it was even suggested the other night that some people are investing in cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin for a bit of action. Is that something that the RBA has to look at, and do you see any threat to this monetary stability in the future from cryptocurrencies?
So cryptocurrencies at the moment are, even though they get a lot of publicity, they're very, very tiny. I think the issues for cryptocurrencies at the moment are more in ASIC's bailiwick. So to the extent that these initial coin offerings and so on, they're not regulated at the moment. I think there might be issues which are more ASIC issues, which are about people being sold things that, or investing in things they don't understand, or things like that. So at the moment, from a financial stability perspective and the bank's perspective, very tiny, watching it, but it's not, but more of interest. And I think the issues more are, as it is in all of the, a lot of this fintech stuff at the moment, how do you let people sort of innovate, but you still protect consumers?
Well, you're talking about households being linked by rising interest rates, but I think quite a few people who are too frightened to really go into the market will be very happy to see the interest rates going up. And I feel that it's ridiculous that so much attention is paid to those who borrow and not for those, to those who are relying on that kind of income. It's ridiculous, and it's causing a lot of suffering.
Yes, and it's a story that we hear regularly. I hear it from my own mum, in fact. but it's a valid point, and that's what, when interest rates move, they affect different parts of the society differently. And when they go up, they affect the borrowers and the lenders' benefits. So I absolutely take your point, and I understand where you're coming from.
And the other point is that parents are being put under pressure to help their children. Those people are going to really be in strife, because quite often they wouldn't draw up a legal document, and if there's a divorce, well, they're going to be really up against it.
Thank you. Fair point.
Do we have any more questions? No? Well, I think it's time to actually say a great thank you to the girls for coming along and for